I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and thank you for joining the Magazine Show podcast brought to you by Golster, the experts in health and well-being, with a range of fascinating guests who stimulate, educate, and make us laugh. Hello and welcome. I am Humphrey Hawksley. This is the Golster Magazine Show and podcast, recorded on the anniversary of Britain's very own Guy Fawkes planning to blow up London, and on the day that Americans are voting in what is described as the highest stakes election for some time. But is it really that? And I happen to be, you'll notice my background is a bit different, I happen to be in Washington, D.C., the capital of the United States, where they're boarding up places in case things erupt. What sort of society are we now living in? And talking of that, my guest today is a forensic crystal ball gazer, well, more scientific than crystal, and he knows about cities, how people live, why we build them, what people want. And my guest is also, I don't quite know how to say that, he's a master of taking an alternate viewpoint. Whatever you might think everyone believes, he will come at it from a different and usually quite credible angle. He's closely connected to Baroness Claire Fox's Academy of Ideas. He's the host of Bookshop Barneys. What exactly is that? And he loves debate. So let's bring him on. Welcome, Austin Williams, to the Golster Magazine Show.
Hello there, Humphrey. How are you?
I'm good. Where are you, Austin?
I'm at the moment in Chester, in Cheshire.
Chester?
Yeah,
is, Chester. Now, is Chester a city?
Chester is a city. It's on the border between England and Wales. As a matter of fact, when the COVID pandemic was around and Wales was having a massive lockdown and England was being a little bit more liberal at the moment, the football matches started up again, Chester Football Ground, until they realised that the boundary line between England and Wales ran through the toilets of the football ground. And there's a bylaw which says you can't have a public meeting if the toilets aren't functioning. So Wales had shut down the toilets and England were playing the games. So they had to stop.
So I'm not going to ask you why you're in Chester, but I asked you why it was a city because you are an expert of cities. What makes Chester a city? What is a city? Just tell us what you mean by this.
Well, I mean, it's one of these unknown unknowns, as they say, because historically, there's been this kind of conception that you can have a notion that a city is a place which has a certain amount of people. So there's our United Nations statistics which say so many people, above which you become a city. There is the idea that if you have a kind of a cultural quarters that you go beyond the rural, so it's not rural, it's urban, they become cities. And also then there's that kind of urbanity idea that, you know, people who are more civilized, let's suggest, not my words, live in cities than in other areas. So there's three criteria. Obviously, the easiest one is the population statistic because it's a numerical, experiential, evidential basis for that. So that's what tends to be used by urban geographers.
Except Jackie, who is in our wonderful audience here, and I encourage, Austin, I've got to tell you this, I encourage our audience to challenge you and to dispute you and to applaud you throughout the show. And Jackie has said a city is defined, I think you mean Jackie, it's got a cathedral.
Well, I'm suggesting in the UK, I agree with that, although there are some cities, for example, St. David's in Wales, since I mentioned Wales already, is the smallest city in the world. It has a population of 2,500 people. In anybody's eyes, it's a really small village, but it's been given a city status. There is a St. David's Cathedral allied to it, but generally it's a really tiny, tiny place. So what I was trying to say is that there are criteria which come together or contradict one another. So if you're living in China, cities are 12 million people, 20 million people. You can go to South Wales and you have a city of 2,500 people, and you do think, well, hang on a minute, where's the comparison? Where's the similarities here? So I'm only trying to say that if you go across the world, urban areas, cities, what's defined as a city, a metropolitan area, change.
Partly and
No, go on, sorry.
And you mentioned that people in cities are more civilized, but you said it wasn't your viewpoint. But what is the difference between people who live in cities and people who do not?
In some respects, you may, this is not a definition or anything, but I come from South Wales. That's why probably why I've mentioned Wales several times already. But
you have. And we're going to be going 5 minutes.
I know. It's terrible, isn't it? I'll be doing a funny accent soon. But the idea that, you know, I used to live in a village in South Wales, which was notable by its net curtain twitching neighbours. So, you know, all of your activities were closely monitored by the people around you. Whereas I do think that, you know, people who come to cities can have a certain level of anonymity. So I'm not necessarily the person who's in favour of urban villages, which I do find to be something of a contradiction in terms. But that idea that, you know, people come to the city to reinvent themselves, to be different people, to meet new people, to have different experiences, is something which maybe is not available to people who live in rural areas. I mean, again, it's not a definition, but it's kind of my maxim.
And whilst you were talking about St. David's there, I was in Ely recently, which is a very small town, but it has got a big Norman cathedral. So I think that Ely must be categorized as a city as well.
Ely is a city.
Monique adds to this, before we're going to move to China, that she said, a city has to have a cathedral and a university to qualify as being one in Britain.
Yeah,
so I hadn't heard about Monique. Yeah,
I'm not too sure. I'll chase that up. The cathedral story is the general rule, but there are cities that don't have cathedrals. But I'll check out what university. But then again, there are so many universities these days, and with polytechnics and places turning into universities at the end of the last millennium, everywhere's got a flipping university. So
that's right. So everywhere's a city because you can always
exactly.
Now you talked about China. We've talked about urban cities now. You have lived and taught in China, and you wrote a book called China's Urban Revolution. Tell us about what does China do differently? I mean, because it's actually building cities from scratch, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's one of these kind of, in some ways, a bit of a myth. I was going to say urban myth, and then I'll have to define what that means. But the idea that China has built lots of cities is kind of true. Although I know I'm very impressive if that's your bag, but I think that when you look at the statistics, even Chinese official statistics, which obviously you can take with a pinch of salt sometimes, the number of cities is very small, or new build from scratch. So
right.
There's Ordos, the very famous one, Ordos in Mongolia, which is a city in the desert. They've started from nothing. But generally what they are, like Suzhou, where I lived for some time in Jiangsu province, that was an existing city, a UNESCO heritage city, very beautiful center. And then they expanded it. So like it went from a place of maybe 2 million people to 9 million people within about 10 years. So,
okay.
You know, so again, like I say, it's impressive. It's a new city in some respects, but it starts with a kernel. But that idea that China is like you just... you know, knocking down things and building cities from scratch isn't really that true. There's about four new cities being built in the last 10 years.
It's the China's Urban Revolution, which I think came out about 10 years ago, did it? Or
yeah, a bit less than that.
It's little 2017, less than that.
2017.
It says by 2025, China will have built 15 new super cities, each with 25 million inhabitants, and will have created 250 eco-cities. That's on the back of the book. Just fill that out for us, will you?
Well, I think the part of that is hyperbole because it's kind of baloney, really. The subtitle of the book is Understanding Chinese Eco-Cities, trying to suggest that understanding any eco-city is kind of worthwhile. So first of all, we have to clarify what a city is, which I haven't done very clearly here for you today, but
it's all right. Jackie and Monique have helped us on that one, so I think we
that's true.
But nailed that one.
True.
Eco city. What is an eco city?
Well, an eco city is a fad which has been around for maybe 30, 5 years. In the West, it's a concept developed by a lot of Americans, which is talking about, you know, that idea of sustainable cities, green cities, environmental cities, that whole shtick that kind of was doing the rounds maybe 30 years ago in this country, really traveled to China in a big way when they started to expand, started to develop architecture and urban design models from 2000 onwards, where they started to say, look, if we are going to build a city, then we want to build eco-cities, which right. are cities which have kind of some kind of environmental criteria built into them. Now, as we all know, China is not the pinnacle of environmental credentials. So in some respects, this was a way of trying to get into the world market and try to get into the, you know, get the certification to try to encourage people to see China in a slightly better light. So instead of the polluting right. industries, you could see the, you know, the grand, you know, the canal networks of Hangzhou. You could see the sponge cities, the way that they were recycling waste within Shenzhen, all that kind of thing. So they really promoted this kind of quite a technical way of understanding what maybe environmental criteria would be. And if you were an official in those cities, you would be at the forefront of pushing it. In which case you'd go and get promoted, the city would get more money, and like that. So it was a little bit of a fake agenda in some respects, or alternative reasons.
You wrote about it, making us all think that there's something new going on, and now you've just poured a lot of cold water on it.
There's something new going. Definitely.
So what is the new thing?
Well, I mean, China is, you know, the world's leader in solar panels and wind turbines and hydroelectric and, you know, whatever it is, right? I mean, they are manufacturing stuff left, right, and center and selling it to the West. As a matter of fact, the West, especially Germany, is complaining because it's undercutting the market because they're selling so cheaply, undercutting the market for wind turbines from Europe. So, you know, China's kind of really realized that if it wants to be seen as a global leader on the world stage, politically, not just, you know, economically, but on the political world stage, then it has to attract foreign workers into the country. Those foreign workers aren't going to come if they have to put a handkerchief over their noses every time they walk down the street because it's so polluted. So they're, you know, they're upgrading. And secondly, I think, which is probably more important, is that, as we both know, China's progress is kind of Western progress compressed into 1/10 the time. So instead of 200 years of Western progress, you have 50. And, you know, look back to, you know, what was being written 200 years ago about pollution, about miasma, about the great stink in London. You know, all the pollution of the water and the air that was happening 200 years ago, obviously happens as any kind of industrialized economy progresses, and China is trying to deal with that in a quicker way.
I'm not an expert, and if any of our audience knows more about this, because you're all over the country, please pitch in. I'm not an expert in how Britain sort of develops new cities, but I do know that in, say, Milton Keynes is a new, maybe 50 years old now, but was concept around Peterborough. There's sort of a new ways of living in that. Well, what would you say China has nailed as a new way of city living that it's created that we haven't done here?
Well, I mean, it's an authoritarian one-party state, Humphrey.
Well, I know that. I know, but putting the politics aside, what as far as sort of solar power or greenness or clean air or anything that is taking place here, does it do that we're not doing?
Well, I mean, I think it is following the Western model. So let's deal with that one first, if you don't mind, right?
I mean,
having been to quite a few meetings with kind of party officials, when you kind of sit around the table and you realize that all of them are incredibly bright. They've all got 3 PhDs from Western universities, from Harvard and Yale and Cambridge. They are, you know, spot on in understanding the world because they've been there, they've written it down, they've kind of technically analyzed it. So they're looking to the West to understand. So, for example, if you look at some cities within just outside Shanghai, you know, they are trying to follow the model of introducing the boulevards of Paris and the canals of Amsterdam and the cycleways of Antwerp and, you know, the front gardens of London. But they travel the world and they pick up these little bits and bobs and they make a composite and they create new cities, new towns, new areas.
Well,
now, as we know, like, cities don't really develop like that. They're much more organic than that, really. And so what China has done, I think probably unlike anywhere in the world, they have like built new areas or new cities, new parts of cities before populating them. So historically in the West, there were settlements, you know, like crossroads, and people would ride their horses and buggies and they would stop and have a pint of beer while they carried on. And you know, after a while, that area would become a little network, maybe a pub would start and maybe a trading station would start. And suddenly people would start to live there and trade. And it grew and grew organically over hundreds of years. China's done that within 30 in some areas. And so, right. So whenever you heard about this, is what really inspired me to write about eco-cities, is that China was being reputed to be building eco-cities.
Yes.
And then when Western journalists went there at the turn of the millennium, they were empty. Nobody lived there. Because China has done this the other way around. They've created cities and then they've shoehorned people into them rather than the people themselves building organically.
So they've created the real estate and the infrastructure, but the notebook. You said something quite interesting there that I could pick up on. You talked about the authoritarian one-party state. You talked about these very bright officials from Harvard and Yale and Oxford and everything. So they have been educated in our democratic system, for want of a better word, coming to work in this authoritarian one-party state. How do they think it all works?
Well, it's a very technical, pragmatic country. There's two things again here. One is obviously, if you look at the way that Western academia works these days, it's fairly authoritarian, one-party-ish. Anyway, the censoriousness within the university sector is quite dramatic.
You mean in the West?
In the West, okay, yes, right. Yes.
You're in the university sector, aren't you?
I am. Okay. Yes. I've come to China and realized actually there's probably slightly worse things, more bureaucratic things happening in the West than would ever be allowed in China. I'm certainly not here to sing the praises of the state. But I do think that, you know, those people who've come and traveled the world, and there are so many Chinese students who are in Western European American universities, trying to kind of get, well, first of all, half of them are trying to escape, and so they never go back. A lot of them, when they do go back, are kind of feeding into the system to try to explain what goes on, because China is still a very naive country. It only opened up, you know, 50-odd years ago, right? So it's still kind of learning the ropes. And what I'm saying is it's kind of doing it in this pragmatic way. You know, that famous Deng Xiaoping quote, it doesn't matter whether the cat is black or white, as long as it catches mice, you know, as long as it does the job, we'll do it. If it stops doing the job, we'll move on to something else.
Yes.
Very pragmatic ideology. And so they are just picking stuff up from around the world and applying it. And if it works, carry on. If it doesn't, we'll do something else. And that's there's something kind of fantastically experimental about that. While at the same time, it's also fairly depressing that they haven't yet developed enough nous and confidence to be able to do something of their own.
We like generalizations because none of us here are specialists, apart from Celia and Monique. It looks like Celia says a local architect had an idea for an eco-village in South Cheshire. That's near where you are, isn't it?
Dave.
The plans were scrapped because the so-called green housing would be very expensive and out of reach first-time buyers or people in less well-paid jobs. Monique says more and more new houses are built without there being infrastructure to support them. That's two slightly different issues. Celia, yes, same as where I live. And Carolyn, yes, me too. More high-rise apartments are being built and no infrastructure. Let's take those two points about the green housing, the sort of utopian world, but people can't afford it.
Yeah, well, it's expensive. There is an industry within this country which has grown up over centuries of, you know, men standing in the rain, putting one brick on top of another with some sloppy cement, right? You would have thought, This is the very job for a robot, but obviously there's an industry, there's a protective world out there. There are so many. There's about 2.5 million people working within construction and its surrounding kind of industries. That it's going to be very difficult to kind of change that, which is why you see, for example, the shift probably about 25 years ago in the West in Britain. When we were trying to get what was called new methods of, what was it called? new methods of construction. Yeah.
Right.
What modern methods of construction, beg your pardon, MMC. And the idea that we would go for prefabrication, that we'd make houses in factories and ship them to site and everything would be kind of milk and honey. Now you see probably, I don't know, I'm going to generalize on the numbers, but a huge number of those new construction companies have gone bankrupt. Partly because it takes a huge amount of money, and as somebody mentioned, infrastructure, in order to set up the factories, to get it in place, to set up the robots, and the money's not there. Partly because the rest of the construction industry is a closed shop.
So getting back to Celia's point, point is that the whole issue, one of the big election issues that we had in the UK was about the lack of housing. Now we're going to build X number of thousand houses that people must be able to afford in order to get them. So does that mean these places are not going to be green? I mean, and how also Monique's point is that, you know, where's the GP surgeries and the schools and the bus routes going to come from?
Well, that's fundamentally important. I mean, look, first of all, you know, we can have a separate conversation about what we mean by green housing. But even if you just, so what I was trying to say is, we're building houses in brick and block or timber and block, as we always have done for the last 100 years. If you want to put a solar panel on the roof, that's going to cost you, you know, X amount of pounds. The payback for a solar panel is roughly around about 25 years. So you're going to outlay a huge amount of money for gains, right? Because it'll cut your electricity bill, but it'll pay itself out in 20 odd years. I mean, this is varied by the fluctuations in the cost of energy, of course. Heat pumps, you know, if you want to have a heat pump in your house on an average, the heat pump itself is going to cost you £5,000. You've got to strip out all your boiler and what have you, and then you have to resize all your radiators and get a plumber in to change all your floorboards. You're probably looking shy of £18,000 outlay for a proper domestic kind of heat pump situation, which obviously it will save you, you know, £400 a year kind of thing, right? We get that.
Okay.
But that idea that you lay out a huge sum of money to get piecemeal returns and in 20 years time, you'll be sitting pretty, by which time, by the way, you have to replace your heat pump because it'll be out of date and inefficient. People are making these calculations, right? And also the industry's not there. The heat pump installation company's not set up because people are uncertain about when the changes are happening, if they're happening, when are we going to go carbon neutral? Is it 2020, 2030, 2035?
And the new houses that are being built here, which, you know, these new developers, are they putting in the solar panels and the heat pumps and costing that into the price?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the home builder and it depends on the location, but there is a requirement that all new homes, I think it's from 2026, should not have gas boilers in them, so they will be putting in heat pumps. Now, heat pumps, as far as I'm concerned, have always been background heating. Yes, so you build up maybe a reasonably substantial amount of heat, but not enough to kind of heat your home. That then has to be supplemented by proper substantial insulation, hefty insulation, almost on kind of Scandinavian terms. You know, this thing, all this kind of costs money, right? And it just adds up, and it kind of, if you're putting in 150 mil, 6 inches of insulation in your cavity, then suddenly you lose floor space because you're shrinking, you're expanding the walls and shrinking the usable space.
And very roughly speaking, for a new build house that has got all that stuff in it, how much more will that cost than a new build house that doesn't have that stuff in it?
That I couldn't even hazard a guess. I'm sorry, I don't really know. I mean, again, it depends on the size. And
that's right. Can I ask you another ridiculous question? I mean, so you've just explained in the UK very succinctly and well, in my view, you know, what's going on there. How would that differ to how the Chinese unfold this solar panels, heat pumps and all that kind of stuff?
Well, because they've come late to the party, you know, they don't have all that baggage of a construction industry, which is kind of holding it back. So basically, almost every house that you go down, every high-rise apartment, you know, up to maybe 10 stories, you see solar panels on the roofs. It's a standard factor, right? But air conditioning is the heating of choice. So that's a really inefficient way of heating, which is then electricity generated, which is then done by power stations. which is why you find China still building coal-fired power stations even today.
Okay.
But you do find an awful lot of domestic scale wind turbines on people's roofs.
And is that because the authoritarian one party state tells them that they should do that?
Well, I mean, we're talking about, well, there's two things. One is the builders themselves, and we all know that the construction industry in China is kind of taken a major hit in the last 2 years with the collapse of Evergrande. Evergrande is a construction developer which had £300 billion worth of debts, £250 billion of assets. So maybe it's not as bad as it sounds, but it's still pretty hefty. So that's having major repercussions. So, but in general terms, house builders themselves will put these things in as standard. But then you will have local people who are trying to save money because, you know, money is everything in China. Very often people who are living in the cities are first generation rural dwellers who've just, you know, been caught up in the whole transition. So, you know, they'll be saving money wherever they can with a wind turbine.
Tell me, in fact, no, I'm going to bring Pauline Blaser's question in here, but then I want you to tell me what your Future Cities project is exactly. But Pauline says 20 years ago, a firm created solar tiles. They tried getting social housing on board, but the housing bosses rejected it as being too complicated for their residents to manage. Solar panels could have been bettered all over with tiles, they said. So that was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And they didn't get signed up on that.
Yeah, that's true.
And Pauline says here also, insulation can be done using recycled plastics, minimal cost. It's not the cost more than the already in control bots won't let go and introduce new methods. This is the whole thing about getting new methods. We should all have small wind turbines on our building. That would cost our cost for electricity, which is what you say the Chinese are doing. Well, Chinese households are doing.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a slight kind of different take on this, which is that, because somebody mentioned infrastructure. So if, just very quickly to talk about infrastructure, it's very true that, you know, when we talk about building 1.5 million new homes every year, or 300,000 every year to 1.5 in 5 years' time, which is what the Starmer government has said. The Tory party said that in 1953. And almost every year we've said that, right? We're going to build 1.5 million new homes in 5 years. And it doesn't happen, right? It just doesn't happen. The moment when it did happen was the mid to late 60s, which ended with Roland Point. So they weren't being built very well. But, you know, anyway, but there's that idea that, you know, that's our target, which we've never hit. But nobody then says, as somebody in the audience mentioned, that obviously you then have to have roads and hospitals and schools and, you know, all playgrounds and all this kind of stuff, which is very seldom costed in. So what you have in the planning system today in the UK is a rather iniquitous, I always like to think of it as blackmail, when if you have a private developer who wants to build X number of houses, you say to them, there's something called a Section 106 agreement where you say, right, we'll allow you to build those provided you build a school playground or provided you give us a park. So it's like taken off the public purse and given to the private sector. And it's almost like saying, if you don't do that, we won't give you planning permission, right? Yeah. So, you know, the notion of the planners being this kind of gatekeepers of good design, in fact, they're actually gatekeepers of, you know, the infrastructural development, but there's also sewage works. There's also drainage. All this stuff.
Sewage is very big now, isn't it? You've started and run something called the Future Cities Project. What is it, and why are you so interested in all this, Austin? Is it something deep in your background and childhood?
I blame my parents. No, I used to run. I just got interested in kind of politics through the prism of what I did for a day job. So I was an architect for kind of 15 years. I then quit and became a journalist and now a lecturer. I started working on the transport research group, which was when, you know, it's hard to remember really, when transport became political, the congestion charge and all this kind of swamp. Remember Swampy? Yeah. You know, stopping roads being built and all the rest of it. It just dawned on me that, you know, I always thought the car was a wonderful liberation. And then suddenly I'm being told it's a cause of death, disease, pollution, and, you know, global domination. And I couldn't marry those two together because I still thought a car was a wonderful thing, allowing mobility for ordinary people. So I just wanted to try to investigate what that meant and why we were, you know, trying to constrain personal mobility. That went on. And then suddenly transport stopped being sexy and went back to being boring again. And so I took up the Future Cities Project mantle to look at how cities were dealing with transport, infrastructure, housing, because there was a whole raft of stuff which I realized was covered by this kind of more broad idea about ambition and aspiration.
Yeah. And would you say that in your time with the Future Cities Project, you've got a top line of where you want a city to go, what it will be like 20, 30, 100 years from now, what our cities will be like?
I don't really have a blueprint. I'm more in the game, you know, the luxurious game of being an oppositional voice where I can criticize without having to maybe put my model on the table. But I do think that there does need to be planning. One of the things which China does, we can possibly learn from, is this kind of 20-year, 25-year master plan scenario. And I, I'm sure you've seen, you know, these models which are the size of a small town, which they have, you know, 1 to 1,000 scale, showing what they're going to be doing in the future. And, you know, that's their plan, and they kind of stick to it. They change it depending on circumstances. But it's that idea about knowing where you want to be. And that's really what you mentioned before, the Milton Keynes, Peterboroughs, the New Town movement, which originated after the Second World War, or the Garden City movement, which started, 120 years ago. Idea that, you know, we do need to have more housing. The idea that we're going to put them piecemeal on bits of brownfield site, little patches of land that we find in urban areas, is fair enough. But I do think we need to start talking about new towns. And, you know, and with as people have said, with proper connectivity, you can start by building all that infrastructure and having it kind of modeled on the basis of capacity, then I think we could do something impressive.
So given that it's taken all of my lifetime and it's still not being built, a third runway at Heathrow, say, given that HS2, I've lost track of what is happening to this high-speed rail, and that China tends to build 6 airports a day and high-speed rails that go all over the place, open at the drop of an eyelid. You say we need to start talking about it, but does our system, as it is at the moment, where the governments say this and then they get in the power and they don't do it, will that allow us to do what you think is necessary?
Well, it will allow us because we kind of did it in the past. I mean, I was coming to the conversation about infrastructure where my ideal, my vision about what I find impressive about the 20th century is the national grid. And that idea that there was a model which said in the 1920s that we're going to deliver electricity to every home in the country. Now, it didn't achieve it, but, you know, 99% it did. And, you know, you can see Pathé newsreels of, you know, people hauling pylons and cables through woods and forests and up the mountain and down dale. It was very, very impressive. And that was a goal, an ambition, which hasn't been surpassed, I don't think. And as a matter of fact, we've kind of lost the nerve to do those things because people might be kind of critical if you took a cable across their land these days, you know, get off my land. So it's a bit of a NIMBY-ish kind of moment in
but politics. I remember, I think, when Jeremy Corbyn was running in one of those recent elections we've had, he said that his government would deliver broadband to everybody in the country. Everybody could set up Wi-Fi. Is that an equivalent to the national grid aspiration?
Well, I think so. I don't even know what Jeremy Corbyn knows what broadband means. But I think it's probably some kind of abacus that he's thinking of. But no, look, behind the scenes, there are very interesting things going on, right? There are, whatever we think of it, Crossrail has happened. Elizabeth Line has happened. There is a new sewer being built finally after 100 years. Yeah. London. I mean, it's very London-centric. But I do think that there are possibilities if there is the nerve and the will and the way. But I think we've become a very risk-averse society where you know, whether it's the money men or whether it's the politicians, are very dubious about whether these things are possible or desirable. Not just short-termism for their own term of authority, because they think somebody else will get in and stop it, but partly they don't necessarily believe that it's the right thing to do. So in many ways, instead of building, you know, drainage infrastructure, we invent something called sustainable urban drainage, which means putting all the water into a ditch or letting it soak into the land, right? And I think the consequences of that are kind of for all to see, that maybe flooding is on the increase. So I think that, you know, infrastructure is so fundamentally important, and we've lost the idea that it is.
I think I think everybody's got to know you a bit, so I can bring in this next topic that we've got here. You did a book, and you have a theme called Enemies of Progress. And I think this is your, I don't know, counter mainstream view of many things in life. Tell us what that is, Austin.
Well, you know, I'm not a contrarian for the sake of being contrarian.
Nobody's accused you of that.
You were getting there, Humphrey, I think that there are part of the idea was the enemies of progress, and the subtitle was called The Dangers of Sustainability. So I'm a person that actually finds sustainability problematic. And so I was looking through whether it was transportation, whether it was mobility, whether it was through education, five topics, I think, in the book, which were trying to say how sustainability is being pushed and what the problems behind that are. So, for example, in education, you can't move for education talking about the environment and climate change and what have you. Now, I'm not suggesting they're not important subjects, right? But I do think, A, they are political subjects, and B, they are being pushed one-sidedly. And I think there needs to be, and with that comes a dearth of open-mindedness in education, which is so fundamental to understanding your critical thinking and developing kind of creative mindset.
Just define sustainability for us.
Well, it's far being from my definition, but obviously the Brundtland definition from 50 years ago is, you know, and I paraphrase, I can't remember the words, but it's, you know, not doing things today which may prove to be harmful to future generations. Yes. So don't do things today which may prove to be harmful. Now, obviously, if that is your mantra, don't do things today in case they are harmful to the future, then the national grid that I just described would never have happened. Yes,
right.
Because, you know, you might say, oh my God, there's all those pylons and they, you know, they might be affecting our brains with, you know, magnetic forces. We shouldn't invent the car because, you know, in 50 years time, it's going to run over 3,000 people. So, you know, suddenly risk aversion, the precautionary principle, is fundamental to the sustainability maxim, which says that, you know, don't do something is much more acceptable and desirable than doing something.
So, on what the enemies of progress, what issues, I mean, if we could drill down a little bit on the issues that you're talking about, are you talking about the push for climate change, electric cars, the wind turbines against coal? I mean, just give us a finer idea of what you're challenging.
Well, if I stick to education, it's slightly more abstract, but it's more telling, I think. And I do know that, you know, if you're in a nursery class, the way you're educated is different if you're a university student. As you know, it's all about open-mindedness in university, and it's all about being told the answer and instructed if you're 5 years old. But I do find the idea that, you know, the vast majority of books, you can walk into any bookshop now and you will find that most school books are either on, you know, are on topics which I find slightly worrying, but are promoting, pushing this idea. And in some ways, it's created a generation. And I'm now, because we're now, what are we, 60 years, 50 years since Brundtland, 79? What's that? Yeah, 50 years. That I'm obviously, I'm seeing kids now as students who have grown up completely with the Brundtland mindset and risk aversion, and they're paranoid about the future. And I don't think that's necessarily a healthy thing to be, right? They're genuinely fearful that we're going to die in a tsunami of whatever, right? That, you know, Valencia is just one example and is coming it down a street near you. They're fearful about, you know, burning to death, about, you know, all the rest of it, right? They don't want to travel. I mean, I'm not making this up. There's genuinely, there's a mood among students of fear of the future, that we're not going to see it, and then all the animals.
Does that fear? You have some backers in the audience. I want some people that are that challenge Austin's thesis here as we go on. But are you saying this is the way that our education system works, and that the parenting takes place?
Parenting is fairly marginal to this conversation, Humphrey, because it's taken out of parents' hands. And it's once you're in school, in loco parentis, teachers are mandating this. Now, again, there's two things just to kind of clarify. One is I'm not blaming the students per se, right? Although maybe they should be a little bit more robust. And I'm not necessarily blaming the teachers, because they are very often mandated by curricula. But the curricula does state that from government edict, but also in the schools. Let's put it in the university sector. Where I am at the moment, you know, the idea that, you know, obviously students pay a lot of money to come to university. University is then worried that students will be upset if somebody in a lecture says, critical race theory is not a problem, or gender critical ideas are interesting, or climate change is, you know, there's two sides to this debate. And the university authorities are worried maybe that young people are going to be upset and withdraw and not come to the universities and pay them the $9,500 that they've been doing for the last 20 years. So the universities are acting with prior worry, prior concern, and imposing it. So, like, you know, I teach architecture, and, you know, if I see another brief written by the university establishment which mandates the use of bamboo or rammed earth or mud or timber or, you know, whatever it might be, thatch is coming back. I mean, this is absurd, right? So I do think that there is something. I mean, look, I like thatch, but what I mean is that if that's the next generation who are harking back to the previous century, then I think we have a slight dearth of ambition.
Just to go back to your Valencia example, because most of us would have seen those pictures and the suddenness of it and the horror of it, in a way, the tsunami type of thing of it. And then, of course, you do get this thing saying this is just a fraction of what is going to happen if we don't cut emissions and all the rest of it. If somebody challenges that and says, well, actually, no, this is a storm, and they've been having storms for a long time, did they get cancelled, as it were?
Yeah, it's never as clear cut as that, is it? I mean, cancellation is just an interesting social form that is very hard to define, but you know it when you're on the receiving end of it. I mean, I'm too old to care, right? So I'm quite
robust. You can speak your mind.
Well, I still get stick. Do you know what I mean? I still get excluded from, you know. But I mean, a friend of mine actually literally got sent to Coventry. I mean, a phrase that you haven't heard for 70 years.
Yeah.
By saying that he supported Brexit, and was so, because basically people who voted Remain, 97% of lecturers, 95% of architects, and 90% of journalists all supported Remain, apparently. So if you're an architect who is lecturing and does some writing on the side, you're in a very kind of a minority amongst your peers. And he voted Brexit and was kind of so ostracized that after 1 year, when nobody talked to him, he left. Now, you could say he wasn't pushed. He volunteered to leave, but, you know, the pressure.
But of course, the whole, and right here, I'm in Washington, D.C., and I've been traveling to New York, Philadelphia, and through now, is that you cannot have a conversation with a group of people to discuss Trump or Harris or what one side believes and what the other side believes, because they is so polarized. And it reminded me very much of the Brexit thing. And that is not what democracy is to be about, which brings me on to the other institution, if that's the right word, you're involved with, the Academy of Ideas, which I've been invited to, luckily, a few times. What is that?
The Academy of Ideas. Well, it used to be called the Institute of Ideas when it first founded, but somebody cancelled it by saying you can't use the word institute if you don't have royal charter, apparently.
Okay.
So it was hastily changed to Academy of Ideas. In some ways, it's a think tank, but basically it organizes events, discussions, debates, films, you know, whatever. It organizes primarily the Battle of Ideas at the end of the year, which is a festival of discussion on many, many, many topics. I think there's about 300 speakers. There's 2,500 attendees. And it's just a kind of a great environment where...
And, And the origins of it?
The origins go back to kind of left-wing organizations in the 1980s. I mean, very few. This is the interesting thing, Humphrey, I think, which is that the shift in the notion about what left and right is, as you say, or Democrat, Republican, you can kind of, obviously, they Democrat and Republican flipped 100 years ago on the slave issue. But that idea that, you know, even now you can see that Trump is becoming the voice of the working man, ironically, yes. And Kamala Harris is going the other way. So you can also see that idea with the notion of debate and conversations, that left wing is, I think, is now anti-censorship in some respects. Left wing is pro-censorship,
right?
And therefore, I'm very often parodied as being right wing, which obviously I'm not. I don't believe I've changed my views particularly. The world's changed around me.
You're a teenage adolescent Marxist, are you, Austin? Or socialist, or whatever it was in that era?
Teenagers, it's very bad lighting here. I probably look older than I am. I'm still kind of ploughing that lonely furrow. But there are a lot of people, and I think there's, as you pointed out, there's a very strange thing happening in society where people are open to ideas. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're not open to mad conspiratorial ideas, but even conspiracy theorists are trying to work it out. They're coming up with some crazy conclusions, right, I don't agree with, but the process, because in some ways people think the world can't be as bonkers as it looks. There must be a reason. And they're looking for reasons. Yes, and coming up with daft things. But I do think that there are rational ways of trying to understand this, and more people looking for those ideas.
But there is a growing mistrust in our institutions, I think, probably because of the social media and all of that sort of stuff. How does it compare to when you were formulating your ideas when you were in your early 20s or something to now? Because you're teaching these people and you've also lived through it yourself.
Yeah, but it's changed. I mean, the classic example is that when I was a student, I was campaigning against foreign students from paying any fees. Because I wasn't paying any fees, and the idea that foreign students would be coming in and paying a fee was reprehensible to me, almost kind of faintly racist. So that was the campaign, right? Today, because everybody's paying £9,000 fees and international students are paying £20,000 fees, there's no student that would even think about having that campaign, because if this international student stopped coming in, their fees would rocket up to £15,000. So you know what I mean? To fill the gap.
So it's a transactional and not ideological.
Completely transactional. It's a very technocratic world in which we live, Humphrey, I'm afraid. People see these things very much in terms of the policies and agendas rather than ideological fights or battles of ideas.
And give me because I think you've had a recent or you've got an upcoming battle of ideas event going on. Is there a top line, a top theme in that that is...
If I remember rightly, it was something along the lines of by the people, for the people, of the people. But it's basically debate allowed, free speech allowed is the key criteria. So you can say what you want. And suffer the consequences. You know, you have to have an argument. Because the part of the problem is, as you've been saying, in the American situation, there's very much a polarized fragmentation within society. But that means people aren't speaking to each other because there's no common connection.
I think you've got it more and more now. You've got the Trump thing, the Brexit thing. You didn't want to go into a room not knowing, in Hong Kong, you've got the pro and anti-China thing. You've got the Israel-Gaza thing. So there's a raft of topics that are not what I would call having a water cooler discussion. So you go up to somebody and say, what do you think of Gaza? What do you think of Brexit? Yeah. That can't happen anymore. Pauline is very grateful to you. I can't see anybody really challenging you. Now I understand why the younger generation blame my generation for ruining everything. That sustainability definition is ridiculous because no one can see into the future. Patrick says, great what you're doing, but what's the prognosis? I like this. Will future cities really be better environmentally and other aspects? Give us a short yes or no on that.
I can give you a short yes. But I mean, the world will be better. I mean, I'm not an optimist ideologically, because I think you have to kind of make things happen. It's not a fatalistic agenda. But the story of historical human progress has been one of gradual evolutionary improvement. Now, obviously, it's not linear. So there will be kind of problems along the way. But, you know, things get better. We use materials much more efficiently, much more productively. We invent more materials. I'm a great believer that the future is a good place to be. But at the moment, it's a very dangerous place.
Yes, you mean at this particular point of time we're having. Celia's got an interesting one. Hey, we have no way of knowing if new cities will be better. Surely a lot depends on population growth, impact of global warming. Some areas may become colder. That's just for counterintuitive.
Some areas may become colder. I mean, I just put the heating on my house. Much for global warming. I'm looking forward to a bit of global warming around my way. But I think that, obviously it depends on a lot of things. It depends not just on population. I don't have necessarily a problem with the growth of population. Other than it has to be in some ways nationally managed. So, you know, the idea that millions and millions of people will kind of flow over borders from Mexico into America, or from French continent, from Africa via France into the UK. I don't necessarily have a problem per se, but it's almost like happening beyond the ken of man. It's just kind of happening. And I think that that's unsustainable, to use the phrase.
Yes.
And so there has to be some kind of conscious intervention. Plus, if sovereignty, if nation statehood is to mean anything, it has to be that you have a border, and then you can decide what you do. But at the moment, nobody's having that discussion or decision, because to have that discussion will maybe label you as a racist, which is obviously not where I am. But I do think that, so population growth per se, I don't have a problem with, and we are all led to believe that that will reach a kind of a tipping point, a turning point where the population will start to go down. Plus, I was talking to Paul Morland last week, who's written this fantastic book on demographics, where he's looking at the population crisis, where people are having across the world. Are having fewer and fewer children. So the decline is around a corner. And he was looking at the impact of that on economic productivity production in the first place. So, you know, there's horses, of course, in that conversation. Yeah. But I do think, you know, things generally are going to improve.
I've just put in the chat the links to Austin's many different hats, but they're all under this one roof of debate, discussion, and freedom of speech, which brings me, if you just tell us what the bookshop Barneys are, and I've been to one, and tell me, they have great fun. What is it?
Yeah, we had a good old ding-dong, didn't we? Bookshop Barneys are Barneys in a bookshop. Barneys meaning a euphemistic term for a bit of an argument, a bit of a battle, a bit of a fight. And, you know, some are more than others, but effectively it's me reading a book by an author and then inviting the author to the stage to present their ideas in just 5 minutes, which I remember you having great difficulty in confining yourself.
It's an hour long for me. Yes. Didn't you know?
but it is the case that I've read it, so I have questions arising from the book, which I then feed you. Some are easy, some are more difficult than others, and some are generally directly confrontational, to allow you a bit more time to kind of expand on your ideas. So I've been to book launches where the chairman says, can you tell me about your book? The author speaks for 59 minutes. Yeah. And then there's one question which says, oh, where do you get your ideas from? Or something. Yeah. And that's the end of the show. And I thought, to give you more credit in the fact that you've written the book, that you've thought about it long and hard to kind of tease out some of those ideas would be well.
And you challenge the ideas, don't you? Tell us, because you've had people like Peter Hitchens there. Tell us some of the stars that you've had there and how you've hauled them over the coals.
Well, I mean, I say Hitchens was a very good example, because he doesn't take telling lightly, but he got told by me. No, it is important that I don't take a contrary viewpoint, but I do read the book with a view to saying, I don't think this is correct. And can you explain it? Can you justify your ideas? So we've had a whole raft of people and now what's interesting is a number of these events, which used to be held and still are held in your physical arenas, but I've realized that Zoom allows you, like now, Humphrey, to interview authors that I would never dream of ever inviting and paying their airfare to come to London for a 1 hour chat. So I've talked to Michael Schellenberger, who some people might think of as an environmental quack, but he was really, really very interesting. I've spoken to Xin Ruan, who's an architect in China. So, you know, we can have a much more fulsome conversation around the table.
So just because I think the Gulster audience would be interested, is they can log into Bookshop Barnes, but also if they're in London, they can go to Foyle still and do it, or do you only do it online?
I hate to call Foyle's out on this, but I've been to now about 6 bookshops, and you know we've kind of agreed that after a couple of years I move on, because I don't pay them anything, and they don't pay me anything. Nobody pays to come; they're all free. But Foyle's, when they moved, if you remember, many years ago, they moved about 4 doors down the street in
Charing Cross Road.
Charing Cross Road.
Yeah,
and that was a massive investment for them. So I got called in and told that I was going to cost me £1,500 for an evening's debate. At which point I said, "Thank you very much, but I'm moving on." I'm in different venues now.
But so you could be doing one in Chester.
I could be doing one in Chester.
Technically.
But it depends on the catchment and the book.
And the book, of course. Austin, sit there for a second. I'm going to tell people what is coming up. Then I'm going to come back for you to sum up our great discussion. God, I've learned a lot. And November the 12th, that is a week from today, Lucinda is with the psychotherapist Laura Payne. She is host of the Dreamboat podcast, a leading voice in dream research and uncovering the mysteries of the mind. November 19th, I'm with Dr. Orit Gal, who is another expert in our cities and societies of the future. And that booking is purely coincidental, I assure you. November 26th, Lucinda is with the Gulster Book Show and Liz Jensen's Your Wild and Precious Life. That is a sad and very uplifting story about the sudden death of her son, Raff, or Iggy Fox, as he was known within Extinction Rebellion, in which he was one of their main leaders. December the 3rd, I am with Angela van Bremen, a soprano soloist, a poet, a wildlife activist, and she has just published her first novel. And that show is at 7 p.m., not 1 p.m., because Angela is in Canada, I think, or she may be in the United States, but she is not in our time zone. Did you have a dream, Austin? Do you have dreams that need...
Do I have dreams? Sometimes I have many, many nightmares, but
Do you dream of a future city and what it would like? Would it be Blade Runner?
I dream of electric sheep, as they say. I'm an architect and an urbanist, so I have certain, you know, likes and dislikes in terms of design aesthetics, but that doesn't necessarily color my belief in you know what should happen in the future. I'm currently in a good old brick terraced house built 150 years ago in Chester, looking out on a backyard. I've got very simple pleasures, Humphrey. I don't dream of a swimming pool and a yacht. But if it came my way, let me tell you, I probably wouldn't turn it down.
No, you wouldn't turn it down. But now just sum up, because I've learned an awful lot about the China thing that I had an idea of, I know in detail, and also what we're doing in the UK as far as building our societies and housing goes. Just give us your own summing up of your own argument.
Go, blimey. I didn't see that one coming. My own argument. I mean, well, it's simply that I want to try to encourage people to debate. That's my discussion. I think whether it's through my university career, where I'm actually trying to get young people to read more widely, because students don't read anymore, read more widely and then discuss it, or just confront people with ideas which are not allowed, in as much as there's an orthodoxy or a certain mantra which kind of people tap into and don't even think that they have the capacity or the right to challenge it. I'll just quickly show you, just on the screen. I've got a flipping filter on my screen, haven't I? If you've got time.
No, we can see it.
There we go.
No, we can see that. Yes.
Yes. I have that one. And I have another one. So I'm basically, again, trying to, 5 critical essays on beauty. So these are 5 critical essays. There's a series of them, 5 critical essays on well-being, 5 critical essays on the crit, which is a way of analysis in the university. It's basically 5 essays from people that I know roughly, And they're not necessarily in agreement with what I think, but I want to just spark a discussion. These are the kind of thing, if you remember, where you kind of read them. They're only small, slim little volumes. You read them. Yeah, you want to leave them on a park bench or on the tube for somebody else to read. That's how ideas get permeated. It's kind of a pre-social media format.
Right. Okay. We are now out of time, but Celia has summed up your summing up even better. You must get Austin back. Brilliant discussion, really thought-provoking. And time's winged chariot is attacking us. Do we know more about the future cities, how they build? Well, I certainly do. And of course, being Austin, I do not agree with everything or even anything that he said. But what a brilliant show. I loved it. Until next week with Lucinda and our dreams. Stay curious. Keep active, be generous, stay social, imagine our future cities and societies, and of course, stay Goldster. Check out the podcasts of past guests just by Googling Goldster Podcast, and an array of beautiful conversations will unfold in front of you. Austin Williams will be there in a couple of week times. What a great guest. Thanks, Austin, for being with us.
Thank you so much. Very kind of you.
Thanks. See you. Bye. Yeah. You've been listening to a Goldster Magazine Show podcast. Check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. We hope to tempt you, your family, and friends into the exciting world of helping everyone live healthier and happier for longer. Find more podcasts just by Googling Goldster and podcast. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and hope you're with us again soon.